go, and if Doug is ready, we can get started. Okay, today we have the famous Doug McClyman giving yet another wonderful talk. I have standard CV to read out, and we've read it out many times. I think the all-important thing is that he always starts by saying he was born 150 metres from the 7th Green at Royal Harare. I don't know what that means to people, but it means something to Doug. I think nearly everybody here knows Doug, so I'm not going to do all the fancy things. But he's a man of many parts, far more than people like me could ever hope to be. And I think you've been reading on chatline some of the things he's been up to. I actually met Doug in none of those things, but in Rotary some years ago. So that's yet another aspect of what he's done in his life. Literally a man of many parts, and I'm just going to say that I'm sure that as in all his talks, this one... Sorry, this one is going to be astounding. And without further ado, I'm going to say, please welcome Doug for his next talk.
Thank you, Robin. Just wait till Mark adjusts it so your hearing aids can pick it up. This morning, the slide I'm showing you now has got absolutely no connection with what I'm going to say. I'm going to start off with a bit of a preamble. Now, some of you know this already. Some of you haven't the faintest idea, but it is important to what follows later. Now, the most prestigious award for bravery in the armed forces for Britain was the Victoria Cross, instituted by Queen Victoria in about the 1850s. And in the warrant that gives the directions for who should be awarded was a clause which she kept in, which said the action had to be vetted by an officer, by a commissioned officer. But often there were occasions where people dashed off in the bush with their sergeants, major and sergeants who did equally brave things. And for this, she instituted another couple of medals. And the first was the Conspicuous Gallantry Medal. Now, when this was first given out, the Navy said, no, we the senior service, that only applies to us. It's one notch under the Victoria Cross, but we the Navy. So only Navy personnel have been awarded the Conspicuous Gallantry Medal. The Army came along and they said, what about us? They said, all right, you can have the Distinguished Conduct Medal. So that's, if you like, the second class Victoria Cross. Now below that, there's a whole herd of medals. Distinguished Flying Cross, Military Medal, Military Cross. There's even a cross for Distinguished Gallantry if you're a nurse or a doctor in the battlefield. But tucked away in there is something which isn't actually a medal. And that's the Distinguished Service Order, which was also put in by Queen Victoria. As she said, this is for those leaders of men who show conspicuous gallantry. So although that it may not be for a single episode in the war, this is to be awarded to someone who led his men into battle. So someone explained it to me, like if you're in the cavalry, against the charge against the guns at Sebastopol, if someone, officer falls off his horse and a trooper goes and picks him up and carries him to safety, he gets the Victoria Cross. Now the idiot in front with his lance or his sabre who's leading this whole lot, if he survives, he gets the Distinguished Service Order. And you're elected to it. It isn't awarded to you, you're elected. Because it's a band of people and they have their own chapel in Westminster specifically for the Distinguished Service Order. So if you get one of those, you can bet your bottom dollar you've done something brave over a period. Now, very seldom awarded for a single action. There are two instances, first in the First World War, on the 13th of the 10th, 1914, at the Battle of Le Cateau, a young second lieutenant leapt out of his trench, charged against the Germans and was wounded. He then survived his wounds, and in the next World War, He wandered about the desert with a beret and two badges on it. The lieutenant was Bernard Montgomery, so he was a hero to start. The second one, in the Second World War, which was awarded instantly, was to a guy called Blondie Hasler. And him and 11 other guys got into little kayaks from a submarine, sailed up the Bordeaux River, and put limpet mines on a whole lot of bombs, on a whole lot of ships, and blew them up. They then sank their kayaks and made home their way home via the land. Now, 6 were caught, and Hitler immediately told the Gestapo to shoot them stone dead. And just remember that, because it applies later on to what I'm saying. The other 6 got home, and they all got VCs and all sorts of things. But Hasler was awarded an immediate DSO. So it's not often that you get award for one action, but generally it's over a period. And Queen Victoria said, no, it's only to be awarded to lieutenant colonels or above. But they relaxed that in the Second World War, and they in fact awarded it to majors. And in special circumstances, like with Montgomery, they awarded to a second lieutenant. Now, the other thing which is quite important, and you'll see why this ties in later on, is to look at the aircraft that were used during the Second World War. Everybody knows the Spitfire and the Battle of Britain and all that. What they didn't know is the Spitfire Mark I had 6 .303 machine guns, average range about 350 metres. And why they had that was because some bright spark in the Ministry of Supply said, if we make all the ammo .303, we can use it in the Bren guns and the rifles that the staff are using. I will see why that's such a bad idea. The later models were, in fact, beefed up, and the Mark 9 had 4 200-millimeter cannons, or 20-millimeter cannons, sorry, the same as the Typhoons that John McCarthy told us about 2 meetings back. Now, the Hawker Hurricane was also put in at that stage, and they both fought against the Messerschmitt of the German Luftwaffe. Now, the Hurricane shot down more Messerschmitts than Spitfire, and the reason was that most of this was fabric and wood. So a guy could come back with a beat-up plane, and overnight the air techs could put it together again and stick it in the air. The Spitfire was all metal, and if it got damaged, it had to go to a machine shop, come back 2 weeks later. Now, the Americans weren't behind this. They didn't want these. And a guy called Curtis produced an aircraft that he asked the American Air Force to test, and they said, yeah, great, we'll have it. So he said, well, where's the order? And they said, no, Roosevelt's saying no war, no war. There's no war, so we don't need it. So poor old Curtis produced his, what is known as his Kitty Hawk. And this was quite a reasonable aircraft. It had 4.5-inch machine guns. It wasn't quite as fast as the other two, but he produced a whole lot, and he sold them to the French. And the French said, yeah, bring them over. But by the time they got them, Hitler had already invaded France, and that was the end of that. So he gave them to the Royal Air Force, and the Royal Air Force said, well, we've got Spitfires and Hurricanes. Let the colonial riffraff have this American rubbish. So these were available to the South African Air Force, the Royal Canadian Air Force, and the Royal Australian Air Force. And you'll see why I mentioned that earlier. Now, the next plane against which they all fought, and which didn't get a lot of modification, was the Messerschmitt 109. Now, this had 4 0.5-inch machine guns, and in the boss here, 20-millimeter cannon. So it had a range of about 900 meters. Now, think of the 303 at 300 meters. Imagine how brave the RAF were to take out so many. But in this particular mix of aircraft, There was one that's only just come to light, and it hasn't been mentioned, and that was the Hawker Hurricane Tank Buster. And this relates to what I'm going to say later. And this had two 40-millimeter cannon, and the whole idea was to take out tanks, and it was very good at tanks. And at the Battle of El Alamein, it took out 20% of the tanks. Now, it wasn't very good at fighting in the air, because that wasn't its job. So the air forces around the Battle of El Alamein had to keep the Germans away. And we'll hear more about that in a moment. Now, when I was at Trelawney, Strathbrown invented his tobacco tunnel. For those of you who don't know about tobacco, it used to be reeped onto strings and put in barns and tiers and the tepees and all sorts of things like that. And Strath put his tobacco on clips onto trolleys in the land, and the trolleys came back to his tunnel, against which there was a force of hot air, and it cured. Brilliant. So instead of 20 labourers loading and unloading barns, you had three guards pushing trolleys around. The other interesting fact was that to cure a kg of tobacco, you need between 4 and 12 kgs of coal, where in Strath's system is one for one. So the farmers are very interested. And at Trelawney, we built one, and everybody came to see it. So I used to get 20, 25 farmers a week visiting. So we laid on tea at 10 in the morning, 3 in the afternoon, and so these guys could have a cup. Now, twice a month, my next door neighbour was Jerry Hartman on Fir Hill, but the other side was Nid Valley, and Jack Parsons, and that was his farm. And he used to pop in on his way to the post office to have a cup of tea with me. And we got very friendly, talked about everything. Talked about golf. He told me that Bobby Locke had coached him. That's why he was such a good golfer, etc., etc. And he always scrounged something off me. So baling twine, seedbed chemical, bag of fertilizer, whatever. So he didn't want to argue with me, and it ended up I was one of the few guys in the whole district he didn't argue with, because, you know, he was getting a freebie every time he said hello. Anyway, while I was there the one afternoon, I said it was the anniversary of my uncle's death in the Second World War. He was a pilot in the South African Air Force, and his plane crashed into the sea outside the beaches of Amanzimtoti, and they never found him. And Jack sort of mentioned that he'd been in the Air Force and didn't take much notice. Now, every month, I had to go into Kutsaga to collect the wages for the staff. And I always used to pop into the Sable Bookshop in Angus Street. It was run by a little old guy in a wheelchair. And the one day I got there, and there was this beautifully vellum-covered official history of the South African Air Force. So I thought, oh, what if my uncle's mentioned? So I look in the back, yep, three sentences. And I remember Jack Parsons had said to me, he'd been in the Air Force, but I wonder if he's mentioned. So I looked up, and he didn't have three sentences. He had three whole pages. So what I'm going to tell you about today is Major Jack Parsonson, DSO. Remember what I said about the DSO? So this guy was seriously blamed, and also a leader. A lot of the people at Trelawney didn't even know that. They wrote a book about him, about the Trelawney area. He's not even mentioned. Now, Jack was, or John Edward, as he's christened, was born at Smithfield in the Free State in 1914. He went to the local school, Tweetalik, so he spoke Afrikaans, and then he joined a bank. Now, it was Standard Bank, so presumably he matriculated, otherwise Standard wouldn't have hired him. While he was there, this knowing him, this brought him to tears. And when he saw the local citizen force militia artillery driving past, he decided that when he was called up for his national service, he was going to join the artillery and drive around on the trucks. So in due course, he was called up in about 1935, trained out to be a gunnery officer. Don't think that took too long because I didn't have many shells to blast off. It was too expensive. But he was allowed to join the officers' training corps. And he went and trained as an officer at Waterkloof in Pretoria and did particularly well. He was commissioned as a second lieutenant. but he learned how to fly. And he got his wings. But after his call-up, even though he had his wings, they transferred him back to the artillery in typical military fashion. And one of the reasons was the South African Air Force had enough pilots for the planes that they had. So anyway, he just got back to, after his call-up, when war broke out. And the Kitty Hawks I mentioned before were now given to the South African Air Force. And of course now they didn't have enough pilots because this was all brand new. So in this manner, Jack was recruited to the South African Air Force, first in number 2 squadron and then in number 5 squadron. And he was posted to Kenya and then to Abyssinia to fight the Italians. Now, if you remember from the Air Force, you hear about all these flying aces. Now, from the First World War, a flying ace was determined as a person who shot down 5 enemy aircraft in the air. If you shot them on the ground, it didn't count. And this came from the great British tradition of shooting grouse and pheasant. If you went out in the Lord and you shot one down, that bird went to the pot and was eaten by the Lord. If you shot it on the ground, terribly unsporting. This was given to the dogs or the staff. So of course, if you destroyed an aircraft on the ground, it didn't count. Now, Jack wasn't an ace. He only shot down 3 planes, but he destroyed over 40 on the ground, which didn't count. Not sporting, you don't shoot them on the ground. So he, from that point of view, he did a lot of damage, but wasn't sort of recognized for it. Now, just before El Alamein, about 1941, there was a lot of Italians floating around in various groups, and the South African Air Force was tasked with shooting them up. So Jack took his guys out to go and shoot up Italians, and the one lot they attacked actually shot him back, and he made a forced landing in his Kitty Hawk. And you can see this as a Kitty Hawk, because it's got this big open cowl here. And then the ones that they used them in Japan, the Americans used them in Japan very successfully, they always put big shark's teeth here, because this is the open mouth of the shark. Anyway, Jack got out of his plane with a water bottle, not a soul around, and for 3 days he marched north. Now here he was, well, he said he marched north. But after 3 days, he was in bad shape. He said when he walked across there, it was flat, it was hot, and there were mirages. So you'd see a building and you'd aim for it, disappeared. And he said he saw this truck, and eventually he thought, it's just a mirage. And he walked, eventually the truck stopped, hooted at him, and he was abused in Afrikaans because it was a South African Air Force patrol, and they picked him up here. Now here's El Alamein, and Montgomery's line to the Katara Depression was across there. That's where he stopped Rommel. Anyway, Jack was given a new aircraft, and once El Alamein had started, I mentioned the tank busters. It was his task in the sort of southern area to make sure the Messerschmitts weren't attacking the ground troops of Montgomery. Now, while he was doing this, a whole lot of Messerschmitts came and attacked him and his boys, and they shot him down. And it was about here, between Bardia and Bolham, so he hadn't got to Tobruk yet. Now, Montgomery's lot were over here, so he was behind enemy lines. And if you ever read Biggle's books, you'll hear about in the First World War, the camaraderie between the Luftwaffe and the RAF. You know, we're enemies in the air and comrades on the ground. Well, these Messerschmitts knocked him down and he climbed out of his plane and 2 of them peeled off and started to ground strafe him to try and kill him. You know, this wasn't a good idea. He hopped under his plane, they disappeared, turned around, and he went to a ruined set of buildings nearby, and he said for about an hour afterwards they tried to kill him. They came from every angle to try and shoot him. Eventually they pushed off, obviously run out of fuel. A couple of hours later, a Wehrmacht lorry arrived and he was captured by the Germans. Now he was stuck in the back, and the second night he noticed they're all asleep, so he bailed out. And they chased him and caught him. And the sergeant major said, next time you move, I'm going to shoot you. Anyway, about a week later, he said you could hear Montgomery's troops coming with the artillery fire behind them. And the guys in his truck were put in a long convoy line, and they were going up a slight incline, going in the middle of the night, and Jack noticed that the guys were vaguely asleep, and he bailed out. Now, there was a big hoo-ha, but they didn't come and look for him because they couldn't leave the line. So anyway, he managed to get into the desert. And while he was in the desert, he came upon a bunch of Bedouin and sort of introduced himself. And eventually the head guy produced a sheet of paper from a long-range desert group saying that these Bedouin were allied friendly and they'd look after him. So when they sort of made their introductions, he took his kit off and they stripped him naked because they wanted all his kit, his South African Air Force uniform, and they gave him one of these burnous things and sandals, so he looked like one of them. He said they looked after him reasonably well. He said he ate some stuff which he'd hate to be identified, but he didn't die. And about a week afterwards, a long-range desert troop contingent arrived, and he thought, oh, thank goodness, so he rushed out in front of them, hello, hello. And the lead driver in the first vehicle said to him, F off, you bloody Arab. So anyway, Jack lost his temper, bluxum, and he swore at this guy. And there was a guy half asleep in one of the other trucks, and he jumped out, ran over to him, threw his arms around him, and shook his hand. And the officer said, what's he? He said, no, this is a South African pilot. So I said, how do you know he's a South African pilot? He looks like a bloody Arab. He said, I've been in the long-range desert group for 2.5 years, and this is the first time I've ever heard an Arab swear in fluent Afrikaans. Anyway, they took him back, and he was united with his squadron again. Come back to that. And while they were chasing Rommel, part of his duties was to also take a look at the coast and shoot down anything that wasn't kosher. Now, this is Zimbri Island. Sounds tremendous. But in fact, it's 20 hectares and it's just a big rock. So the German torpedo boats used to hang around at the back there. And Jack and his three squadrons came in and took them out. Unfortunately, they returned fire, and he got hit and had to bail out. So he got in his little dinghy and went on to Zimbri Island. That night, he decided it's only 20 k's from there to there. He'd get in his little dinghy and paddle across. But when he was about halfway across, an Italian torpedo boat pitched up and grabbed him and took him right behind the lines here, because Montgomery was here somewhere with the 8th Army. And they realized he was a South African of some importance, so they flew him to Sicily. Then they flew him to Rome. And then he was put on a train. And after a couple of weeks, he arrived at Stalag Luft 3 prisoner war camp. Now, this was a special camp that had been set up by Goering only for airmen. And it had about 10,000 airmen in it. The southern compound was all Yanks, and they didn't do a lot. The northern compound was two British sections, if you like, and they were the ones that caused all the trouble. They had a guy there, a wing commander called Day, he used to know Wings Day, and he caused so much trouble they transferred him to a prisoner of war camp miles from Berlin. Because Stalag Luft 3 was at Sagan, which is about 150 k's southeast of Berlin. So if the bombers attacked Berlin, Jack said you could actually hear them, hear all the banging and crashing. Having been shot down where he was one of the few airmen who was shot down on land, in the air, and at sea 3 times. So, because most people were shot down, that was the end of them. Now, at Stalag Luft 3, there was another South African called Roger Bushell, and this is a character on his own. He was born in Springs, in the Transvaal, so South African, and his dad was one of these mining executives, Stark Robin, with lots of money. And they took him overseas, and he was educated overseas, went to Cambridge University, got a law degree, only just. He skied for Britain. He spent most of his life on the continent skiing, learnt German and French, could speak it fluently, and somehow he managed to get in charge of the escape committee at Stalag Luft 3. Now, he was a squadron leader, and he graduated, there was a lawyers section in the RAF where all these lawyers got together and learned how to fly. And he went there and went to all his prayer meetings and that, and was promoted to squadron leader before the war began. Never been in combat, but he was promoted to squadron leader. And on his first trip, he was shot down. So, not a very distinguished war career. He then escaped 4 times from the Germans. The one time he spent 4 months in Prague and was only given up to the Gestapo when the woman he was shacked up with, he dropped her, so she reported him to the Gestapo. So he wasn't so keen on getting out. But he took over, and he was a very plausible guy. And he was the one that started this thing that they wanted a mass escape from Stalag Luft 3, 200 guards, because they're going to stop Hitler's war effort. He'll have to divert people, and it was all nonsense. Now, when Jack arrived, they immediately locked horns, because there was a great snobbery between the RAF and the Canalian riffraff, as far as the Air Force went. Now, if we just look here, just to compare the two, Parsons was a major. Bushell was only a squadron leader. Now, the South Africans were typical. The RAF had all their ranks of pilot officer, squadron leader, wing commander, group captain, etc., etc., etc. The South Africans retained their army ranks. So they went from a flight lieutenant, captain, major, and Jack was a major. He was born at Smithfield. Bushell was born in Springs. School, Queen's College, Wellington College, Berkshire. Worked in a bank, got a law degree. Promotion, 1942, he was promoted to major in number 5 squadron. Bushell was promoted to squadron leader in 1939, never been in battle. The decorations we see there, all the decorations that Jack got, Bushell was only mentioned in dispatches when he was dead. Now, in the escape plan, Bushell had got this thing where 200 are going to escape, so here's the list of all the guys. And he put himself at number 7, because he needed a couple of guys in front of him to dig out of the tunnel. He wasn't going to do it himself. And Jack was in the top 15. And in the top 15, these guys were outfitted with everything: maps, money, forged documents, proper civilian uniforms, etc., etc., etc. Now, at number 9 in the list here was a guy called Johannes Gauss, who was a South African. Now, while this was happening, the Red Cross came along and said, Jack has been awarded the DSO. So immediately Bushell said, fine, we're rearranging the list. And Jack went from being in the top 15 to the top 50. And then he was again reassigned in another draw to 199th, second last. Because Bushell and he did not see eye to eye. Now, just a quick thing on the Great Escape itself, and this is a huge subject on its own. The Brits dug three tunnels, Tom, Dick, and Harry. Tom was discovered, but Harry was the one that they concentrated on, and the entrance was hidden under a stove, which was lit all the time, so the Germans never suspected it. The soil here is awful. If you know the Kalahari sand around Vic Falls and that, it was the same. No structure. So if you dig in it, you've got to line the tunnel with boards. And these were the sleeping boards from the guys' beds. Now, these guys did wonderful things. They had a workshop here. They had a guy here with a canvas bag pumping into klim tins, which went all the way down here. So there was air conditioning. The whole thing was connected to electricity, so they had lights all the way down. There was an area here they called Piccadilly Circus where guys could get up and walk around and stretch their muscles a bit. This whole thing was a railway. Had little trolleys with wheels as klim tins with a rope so people could be pulled along and the sand could be pulled out. And then this was going to be the big tunnel where the 200 were going to escape. Now, there was a problem. This was surveyed by the various surveyors in the camp who were also airmen. And this is the picture that you can go and see now, because Sagan is now in Poland. So if you want to see this camp, you've got to go to Poland. And that was the tunnel, and that was the forest they were meant to go in. Now, it doesn't show it too well here, but in fact, the end of the tunnel was there. It's 20 meters from the forest, 20 meters short. And over here was one of the guardhouses. So they had a real problem getting the guys out. Now, one of the guys who, and all the surveyors in this country used to give him a hard time, was Des Plunkett. Because they said, when you're at the camp, you measure this thing short. You're not much of a surveyor, are you? But in fact, it wasn't his fault. He had nothing to do with the surveying. He was a cartographer and made all their maps, so he did a fantastic job. But as far as the whole story of the Great Escape goes, there are two books. Now, the one came out very early on in the 50s by Paul Brickhill, who was an Australian actually in the camp, and he wrote about the Great Escape. Well, it was almost a book of fiction. What he said wasn't actually what happened on the ground. There were so many inaccuracies that eventually the guys got pretty upset. And this guy, Guy Walters, wrote The Real Great Escape. And this is a very interesting book. It's quite thick and very well researched. He told them what really happened at the Great Escape. The first 15 got a full house in terms of money and kit, civilian kit, forged documents, etc. The next 20 got about 80%. The ones behind that, and they themselves christened themselves the hard asses because they got what they could get. So Brickhill maintained that every single escaping prisoner had been fully outfitted. Wasn't the case. And in fact, if you go onto YouTube and get into the Great Escape, you'll get some of the interviews of the guys that actually they managed to catch them before they died, who actually escaped. And this was a great problem. Now, when the escape started, Bushell was in charge, said 24th of March, 1944, in the middle of the coldest winter they'd had for 40 years. So you can imagine, all this area here was all covered in snow. So if you're 20 meters short and you're going there, you'll leave a track here, won't you? Now there's a guardhouse here with guards looking around. So not the most ideal situation. Anyway, when he got there, they had a plan that when they escaped, there were two big trains that they could catch and get the hell out of there. But they didn't actually do that because when they got to the end, they found the top area was totally frozen solid. So the guys digging took another 2 hours to get out. Now, what is amazing with these guys is that you think you're digging out of a tunnel, and there's a tree. You're not going to dig under the tree. How can you get through a tree? And they didn't pick up the fact that there were no roots. They just dug this thing straight up. So when they came out, they were short. You would have thought that somebody there would have put into it. And this guy, Walter, said, well, he could understand that because on the hype that went with it, the ex-committee had a mining engineer. And that sounds great. You see, there we're tunneling, we've got a mining engineer. First class. Well, what they didn't tell you was the guy, a Canadian, was a mining engineer, and he ran a big mine, but he was an open-cast miner. These are the guys that blow up rocks and then cart them out in big trucks, so he knew nothing about tunneling. Anyway, because they were late, Bushell sent a message down, only the first 100. And that, in fact, saved Jack's life, because he was second last, so he had to put everything away. 76 of them got out. And when Hitler heard about it, remember what I said about the cockleshell heroes earlier, he ordered they all be shot. And Goering managed to talk him down to 50. And there was a guy called von Leber who was given the task of deciding who'd be shot. Quite ironic, because he was in a plot against Hitler a couple of months later, and Hitler hung him on an 8-gauge wire. So he sort of paid for it. Anyway, the guys were basically caught, only three got away. One was a Dutchman, and two were Norwegians, and they got to Sweden. As Walters has pointed out in his book, the three that got away looked like Europeans. Even though the Brits had tailors and everything, they looked like Englishmen. It's like if you go overseas to Paris or a place like that, you can pick up the Yanks straight away. You can see them. And it was the same in Europe. If you wasn't a European, you looked like a Brit. And what Bushell didn't know, and this was a bad piece of intelligence, was that the Germans had a warning system over the whole country in various stages of red, amber, and green. So, and if the red went out, every single government official was on the lookout for escaped prisoners. So whether you were guys selling railway tickets or sweeping the street or cop or whatever. And this general warning went out. So these guys were basically up against it. And 73 got caught, 50 got shot. Des Plunkett was quite fortunate because he escaped and went the wrong way. And he got arrested by the normal creepo or the normal sort of police, and they drove him back to the camp. So he didn't get shot and came to plague everybody in Umtali and various other places later on. Jack was lucky because he, in fact, managed to get out of this. Everything then closed down till the end of the war, and he could hear the Russians coming closer and closer. And suddenly, when they were quite close to Berlin, the Germans suddenly said, up sticks, and they cleared the whole camp and marched everybody southwest. And Jack said this was one of the worst things he's ever done in his whole life. Said he and a couple of other guys were happy they made a little sled to put all the belongings in, because the guys could only take what they could carry. They said for 6 weeks they marched with no food, water or organization, except the guards keeping them in a big bunch. Now, in Walter's book, he said an American major in a jeep pitched up and saw these guys and immediately got rid of all the German guards and repatriated them. In Jack's book, he said it was a British guy. So take that as it is. Anyway, from his point of view, he made his way back to Holland using various contacts in the Air Force, and they flew him back to England in a Lancaster bomber. Back in England, he was promoted to Lieutenant Colonel and took over the 5th Squadron of South African Air Force. Now, while he was there, one of the Curtis executives came over, and because he'd been flying Kitty Hawk, said, come and visit the factory. So he took Jack over and they went around the factory. And this guy got very friendly with him and used to come out to South Africa for a holiday, and Jack used to look after him. While he was there in the next couple of months, it was gazetted in the London Gazette of his DSO, and that's just an official gazette taken on the 25th of May 1943, which the Red Cross then passed on. So he received in 1947 his DSO from King George. Now, all you people who are royal family fans and everything, who's this? Anybody tell me? I'll give you a thing. He was a group captain. Here. Well done, exactly. Thank you very much. Peter Townsend, group captain Peter Townsend, the King's equerry, and the lad that the Queen Mum and all the others wouldn't let Princess Margaret marry. So a little bit of trivia. Now, when Jack came back to South Africa, he actually got married to General Buddy Venter's daughter in 1946. He resigned from the Air Force in 54, and he was divorced in 1964. And around about then is when he came to Rhodesia to farm on Nid Valley. Now, when he came, he married Joan Oliver from the UK. And there was a bit of a strange situation here. I always found it strange visiting, because Joan was divorced from her first husband, and he had a stroke and was a paraplegic. And Jack built a little cottage on the farm for him, and they the whole lot lived together. It's a bit complicated anyway. Now, Jack was quite a character. He had three loves, polo, and he built his own polo field on the farm with his polo ponies and everything. Golf, he built his own golf course. Now there's a picture of Bobby Locke, who in fact he said trained him, taught him how to play golf. Now this is sitting in Alexandria. I looked at these guys here, couldn't actually see Jack, but he did say he played with Bobby Locke. So there was a little bit of truth in that. Sometimes with Jack you had to, grain of salt was not enough. Let's just get back to him getting his... on the polo side, and I got this from various sources, he joined Bankert Polo Club with a Nichols Rannert, argued with him, went to Sonoya, set up there, he was in their first team, as played at number one, and he was a handicap of two at polo. Not that that means anything to me. Anyway, he was played there in the first team, and he was replaced the one year by Gary Hensman, who was younger than him and better than him. So he got in a big huff and went to Mboi with Peter Flanagan, had an argument with him. And eventually, he ended up playing polo in Fifth Street, the Salisbury Sports Club. That's before they moved to Thorn Park. And all his polo ponies were shunted around wherever he went. Now, while he was at Sonoya, he used to indulge a bit after each game. And the one time he went, he told these people for about a month he was getting new boots from England. So sure enough, the boots arrived and he played in his boots. But he found they're new and a bit tight. So he went home that night full of scotch, sorted out his barn boys. And as he was walking past the workshop, he decided, ha, there's the vice. Now that's a brainwave. So he climbed up on the bench and clipped his boot in the vice. Now, what he didn't realize was with his, in his inebriated state, he tightened it too much. He couldn't get his foot out. So he sat down and with all the scotch fell asleep, and eventually he slid off the bench. So in the morning when he woke up, he's on his shoulders on the floor with his boot stuck in the vice, and he couldn't reach the handles to undo it. So when his guys came, of course, they let him out, and everybody got severely shouted at. Then he went back to play polo the next game, and his boots were all scuffed and didn't look like they'd just come out from England. So when they asked him what happened and he told them, they all collapsed laughing. And he didn't think it was funny at all. Anyway. His second love was golf, and he said he was taught by Bobby Locke, and he had a handicap of about 6. Now, in the Limagandi area, there's an inter-club competition called the Dumuk Cup, which has a history of its own. Trelawney used to be known as the suicide area, and Dumuk committed suicide, and somebody donated the cup in his memory to the club. And all the various clubs used to play on a home and away basis. And in Jack's team, there was Jack Miller from Bonanza Farm. He was an ex-golf professional. Jack himself, John Hick, from father of the Golden Girls and the cricketer. John Launder, Alec Houston was the captain. He played off about 4. Now, they used to drive all the way to Mangula and Karoi and various other places. The one day they were playing at Mangula, and when they finished, they were driving back, and Jack and Alec Houston got into a violent argument, and he was very good at violent arguments. Jack got to Lion's Den, stopped the car out, and chucked him out on the road and drove off. So I said to Jack, what happened? He said, well, I walked home, back to the farm. A bit strange. He said, it was a hell of a lot nicer walk than when I walked through the desert. He said, it's nice and cool, and there was a bit of moon. The next Thursday, which was the golf day at Trelawney, he pitched up, opened Jack's boot, got his clubs out as though nothing had happened. And that was his sort of the way he did things. His other love was bridge, and he was always in the Limagandi Championships, and he won it quite often because at Stalaglov 3, these guys played a lot of bridge because they had nothing else to do. Anyway, the ladies at Sonoya got up a petition that they didn't want to play with him because he said that he was too fierce, because he had 2 sayings which he must have picked up in the army. The one was, madam, if stupidity was music, you'd be a brass band. And the ladies didn't take kindly to that, because the other one was, madam, you're so stupid. Your whole life you're a stupid woman. Why don't you give yourself the day off? And then, of course, when some lady trumped his ace, you also discussed their parentage in a negative fashion after that. Anyway, the one day at the thing, 2 colleagues of mine in Connex were at a tobacco field day at Karoi, and they came back and decided to have a nightcap at the Sonoya Club. So Chris Sharman and Roger Barclay-Smith went in, this lady came out and said, please, it's a Limagandi Championship, so we're too short, and please come, do you play bridge? Now, the wrong 2 guys to actually ask, because they used to play bridge in Karoi with the flights. We're going to Morags in a month or 2 time for the AGM. And it was called brandy bridge. You had a brandy between each hand. So you can imagine what sort of bridge it was like at the end. Anyway, they said, fine. And Chris Sharman went to the waiter and said, every 20 minutes, 2 brandy and soda. So they went and had a super afternoon, eventually, or evening rather, and eventually the competition was over, and Jack and his partner had won. And Chris and Roger Barclay-Smith came 3rd. So the lady came along with a bottle of wine and said, here's your prezi. He said, by the way, thank you for helping us. But if you want to play again, you've got to join the proper way and play subs and this and that and the next thing. And by the way, in our competitions, we don't drink alcohol. Tough, you know, we've had our brandy already. Anyway, Jack came up and lost his temper with these 2. Eventually, Roger said to him, you know, if I was a member, you're so rude, I'd resign. But seeing I'm not a member, I'm not going to resign, and I'm taking my prize home. So Jack then blew his top. And apparently the correspondence between him and the organisers filled a whole Lever Arch file. So that was his contribution as far as sports went. Now, When I was talking to Jack, he always said that he'd write it up about it. And he did. He wrote this book. It's called A Time to Remember by Jack Parsonson. Now, remember I told you about that Curtis guy who came and visited him in South Africa? Well, anyway, after Jack died, Joan said that he wrote all his memoirs, and she'd been around all the publishers in South Africa that wouldn't publish it. I can see why, it's a bit thin. Anyway, this American guy said, no, I'll publish it. And that's why this is actually published in America and sold out immediately. Now I got a copy because I went to the charity shop at Arundel looking through the books. There it was. So I said to the lady, how much is it? $1. Oh, thank you. So that was that. Anyway, Jack, after he did a bit of farming, in 1981 he sold his farm to Ben Mugabe, who was the great leader's nephew. And through a bit of finucane, and I suppose with Mugabe's thing, he managed to get all his money out. And he went down to Knysna and bought a plot of land there, 6 hectares, built an A-frame house and did a bit of market gardening. And he wrote his book. But his health started to deteriorate. And he had a triple bypass, and eventually, with the arthritis and thing, he had to give up golf. And him and Joan moved into the local Knysna old folks' home. And there he died at the age of 78. Now, after he died, his medals suddenly came up for sale by Sphinx. Now, Sphinx are the Militaria auctioneers. And you can see there's his DSO, his Africa Star, his North Africa badge, his 1945 war badge, etc., etc. And they were sold for £4,500 to an unknown buyer. And although I was proud to count Jack as a friend, that part of the family just disappeared. And Jamie Whitelaw, who was the police at Bankert, moved to Knysna, and he got very friendly with Jack, and they played golf together. And I got hold of him the other day and said, what about Jack? He said, no. All the years I knew him, he never spoke about his family. And it was only going through his book I found out that his mother's name was Higgs, and she came from England, and that's where he got his plummy accent. And he had a younger brother, William, who actually flew Lancaster bombers. Not a word. So that part of the Jack Parsonson era just disappeared. And it's like everything. At the moment, if you try and find anything, you just draw a blank. But I was very happy to have my scrounging friend as a South African war hero. If any of you knew him and have any anecdotes, I'd love to hear them. Otherwise, any questions?
Okay, questions, and there is a roving mic coming around with Marco for that.
I'm called Mike, by the way.
That's always a bad sign. Either very well done or bloody awful.
What over here?
Stuart.
Thank you, Dr. Doug. Can you hear? Is that better? I can't. On the medals there, the one in the middle, it's got. What do you call that? Okay, great. I was going to ask what it's called, but I've heard it's called a bar. What did it say on the bar?
North Africa, 1939 to 45.
So that's it's a campaign medal.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you,
Dr.
Thank you.
Did he have any children? No, not to either marriage. And I think that's the part of the problem. We can't find him, because that's, you know, with no kids, everything just folded in.
Okay. Yes, I knew there'd be one coming here.
Doug, was Des Plunkett related to Lord Plunkett of farming in Tumani Mani area?
I think so. That he was in... John Reeler knows more about him than I do. He was in Mtwari for a while. As in that chat line thing, he was responsible for flying the whole country and taking pictures. Because certainly in Connex, we had a lot of the contact prints that these guys produced that we used to look at stereoscopically to look at dongas, you know, like on Basil Wakefield's farm.
I found the talk absolutely fascinating and commend you on your research. Quite incredible when you say there's not a lot to be found, but well done.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I know what's going to happen. You're all going to go, and then you're going to think, there's a question. Why didn't I ask it there? But you can all get in touch with Doug for more information than that. Now, I'm going to ask Marco here if he will do the formal thanks to Doug for what's happened.
Thank you very much, Doug. A great raconteur, I'm sure you'll all agree. So another hand of applause to him. I certainly learned a lot about the military and about Stalag, and I'm sure you all did. And as a sign of appreciation, Doug, a nice little bottle of Merlot.
Super, thank you, Walker. Excellent.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming.